This will be an unusual back-of-the-book program. It's a new program, but it was pre-recorded Friday night. Here and there, you're going to hear a tone in the middle of this program. That's where I was coughing a great deal, and I put a beep in because otherwise it might have sounded worse with gaps where I'd edited out the coughing jags. This only happens a couple of times. The vast majority of coughing jags are just edited out entirely.
Hello, this is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the Feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top of the line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. Well, okay, we went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It is about 5 a.m. or so, and you're listening to all 3.14159265383589723283462634338322794197169399379 Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Well, good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. My name is R. Paul Martin, and she is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to all our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
Indeed. And in fact, this is another pre-recorded program, because I'm still sick enough that, you'll remember on our last thrill-packed episode, which was 4 weeks ago, since we were preempted 2 weeks ago. I was sick then, and we had to pre-record that program. Well, I'm better, but not better enough. Plus, of course, Pickles of the North has to be away this weekend, so we decided that probably the best thing would be to do another pre-recorded program, which is what this is, and we hope that one will be here on March 28th. You never know. And at that point, if we are here, we will make every effort to show up live and do a freeform live radio program. This, I guess, will be a freeform pre-recorded radio program. And there you are. Now, for the last program we did on February 14th, the archives were screwed up. And so what we did is, since it was pre-recorded, it was pretty easy for us to put out an archive of our own, and that is posted, and you can access that through the webpage for the previous program. This program also has a webpage, and you can get to that by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can go up to glib.com, and on the left side of your screen, you'll see a navigation frame, and at the top of that, you'll see a link that says Latest Back of the Book Program Links. Just click on that, and you'll get to the webpage for tonight's radio program. If the archives are still screwed up, which is entirely possible, we will, again, put our own archive up there. And I'll probably get it up there sooner than I got the last one up there, because I'm not in as terrible a shape as I was 4 weeks ago. That was pretty bad. Anyway, so we have that going on, and we don't know what the stream status is, of course, since this isn't live, but we hope that there are numbers of you out there on the internet listening to us. All right. And since we were preempted for the previous program 2 weeks ago with not much notice, we didn't get to do anything for Intergalactic Gals Day, which was last weekend. However, Pickles of the North does indeed have something for Intergalactic Gals Day. And Pickles of the North, take it away.
Yes, my dear. Well, I was at the library, and I found these two books on the shelf side by side. One was The Astronaut Wives Club, A True Story, by Lily Coppell, and the other one was Women in Space by Karen Bush Gibson. And the interesting thing, these are not new books. One, I think The Astronaut Wives was released last year, and The Women in Space was the year before that. But it was very interesting to see them there because now we're used to women going into space, going up to the space station. I think there have been at least 65 women who have participated in the space program now, the international space program that all the friends in space are supposed to have. But back when the astronaut wives had a club, these were the wives of the men who were the pilots who were the chosen few for the first space program in the United States, the Mercury astronaut. And their job was to keep their men happy. In fact, they had a representative from NASA who would come and tell them, you've got to give your husband a good breakfast, support him in everything, don't bother him with the domestic stuff. I mean, it was really an interesting way of doing things. And right up to the shuttle program, this basically was the role of women. You could not be an astronaut. If you were a wife in an unhappy marriage with one of the chosen astronauts, you had to stay in that marriage. And there was a lot of mayhem that occurred from this going on. And apparently in the Soviet Union, the then Soviet Union, the same thing was going on there, except they decided to have a token woman go up because they had already beaten the United States with having the first person in space, the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. And so having the first woman in space, they really weren't interested in having women going into outer space, even though they tested a bunch of them. The same thing happened in the States before the Mercury astronauts. There were 13 women who were tested who scored way better than all the male candidates, and not one of them was allowed to go into space, not even 20 years later, when a couple of them were still hale and hearty and ready to go up on the shuttle, you know, if only given the opportunity. No, who was given that opportunity? John Glenn, 77, who, by the way, during the 1960s, testified before Congress and said that he felt women should not be astronauts. Do you want to know what the big reason was for that? Well, women have periods, and their brains might not work properly in space. Yes, indeed. Well, the first Russian female cosmonaut, Valentina Tereshkova, she was a worker in a textile factory. But they picked her because some of the other women, the other five candidates, were a little too mouthy about standing up for themselves as women, or they got sick when they did some of the tests and had to drop out. She studied really hard. She went up into space. She disobeyed an order she was given, and when she came back, she was berated for this. And I'll tell you what this is. And this was also endemic in the U.S. space program, too. If something went wrong, the astronaut was blamed for what went wrong, even if it was a mechanical failure, even if it was a bug that hadn't been worked out, the astronaut was blamed for it. So she was blamed because she did not fire her retro rockets when they wanted her to. It turned out, years later, after being berated for this, if she had fired those rockets when she was up there, I think she was in orbit for 3 days, she would have left Earth orbit and been lost in space. She knew something was wrong. She radioed back to them. There was something wrong. She refused to follow the instructions. They did the calculations. They found out, uh-oh, she's right, but they kept that quiet. They did the same thing to one of the male astronauts when he splashed down, Gus Grissom. His capsule started sinking, This was not his fault. There was something wrong with the hatch. So this gives you an idea of these big space programs. They didn't treat the men very well, but they treated the women even worse. And the worst thing they did was not let women participate. Not let women participate and go into space. The Soviet Union, they had the first woman up, Valentina, in 1963. The next woman didn't go up till 1982. And the reason they sent her up, because they found out that, the United States was going to send their first woman up. Sally Ride, of course, who went up in 1983. So it was kind of heartbreaking to read about, in both these books, the women who were left behind on Earth while their husbands were flying off all over the place and being treated like rock stars and had what they referred to as cape cookies, who would follow them. And, you know, there was a lot of infidelity, a lot of alcoholism. Huh. And then to read about the women who did qualify and were stopped because, you know, they were going to go crazy because of having a period in space. Or women in the Soviet Union who were just used for propaganda purposes. And there were other women who wanted to be in the space program, and none of them ever got to go and fly. So it made me glad that today in the 21st century, if you want to take part in a space program, and there are many countries now that have them, you know, your gender is not going to stand in your way. And now, of course, we have astronauts of all different colors. And these are all really, really good things. And so it doesn't take away the lost dreams of those early women. But if you're a young girl today, you have a chance to go into space. And being a girl isn't going to be something that disqualifies you. So that's what I was thinking about when I was reading these books. And they're both quite good books. And you can get them out of the library. And those books, once again, are The Astronauts' Wives Club, A True Story by Lily Coppell, and Women in Space by Karen Bush Gibson. And that is actually a book written for kids, but an adult can read it. It's got a lot of information in it.
And thank you, Pickles of the North. And before we go any further, we would like to offer a huge thank you to our own Maxwell J. Schmid, because we were, in fact, having to do a pre-recorded program the last time we were on, 4 weeks ago, and we got that in a little bit late because I was so sick and I was screwing things up. Anyway, Maxwell actually stayed late and got us on the air. If Maxwell hadn't done that, we would not have gotten on the air. So we'd like to thank fellow saddle pal Maxwell J. Schmid for helping us out there and really making it so Back of the Book could air on the February 14th program. Thank you, Maxwell. All right. Notice of regular WBAI local station board meeting. The next WBAI LSB meeting will be held on Wednesday, April 8th, 2015 at a location to be announced. At the last meeting, which was this past Wednesday, we kind of picked some members to go on the Pacifica National Board committees, and we luckily just barely voted not to approve something that hadn't even been written yet, really. Let's all vote to approve this. We not only can't see it, it hasn't been written yet, and that motion was actually made. And the star of this particular program is going to be the radiator that's in front of me. Well, not that close in front of me, because it's going on and I'm having to pre-record this at home. And here I am in the living room and the heat is coming up. Not that we're complaining about the heat coming up, but you're going to hear the radiator. You might even hear some noises from out in the street as trucks go by and stuff like that. This is life. We're not in a studio, we're home. Anyway, what else happens? I will note that we were preempted on February 28th, which should have been our last program. It was a pitching program, and this again shows the vulnerability of a radio program that's not raising as much money as the hypnotism and cure-all premium programs that are repeated during the thons do. Management could just devote the overnights to such stuff and try to raise money that way. Let's hope they don't, but when we next pitch, that's in May, we sure hope people will contribute. And in earth-shattering news, I am now up to 44 followers on Twitter. Oh my godlessness, isn't that amazing? 44 entire followers. It's gigantic. It's super duper. Oh boy. Let's see, what else? I'm still sick. I have a headache. I'm coughing. I'm editing the coughing out of this pre-recording, but it's happening. And I'm just having not a great time with all of this stuff here. And so, it's really not feeling well at all. And, let's look at the Science Times here for February 24th. And there's a question. Is it possible to get two different strains of flu in the same season? The answer is yes. And basically they're saying there are three strains of the flu going around right now. And yes, you can indeed pick one up after you've had another one. I think that's what's happened. I have, I had the flu. I had the flu 4 weeks ago. And, oh boy, it was really bad for a while there. Temperature, it was rather serious. Anyway, so we did a pre-recorded program. And, well, I had to go to meetings and stuff. And I did have to go to a meeting on February 19th, which just happened to be the coldest day of the year. That's the day we got down to we set a record. And when you set a record low in February, you know it's pretty low. And so we set a record low. It was in the low single digits with a wind chill well below zero. And I had to go trudging out and go to a local finance committee meeting because I chair the local finance committee. And so we did that. And then we met in 60 Wall Street, the atrium at 60 Wall Street. And that's a barn. It's not heated. Oh. And so I came back from that and got a bit worse. I don't know for sure if I caught a second influenza or if I had a relapse just because, you know, I was weakened a bit by going out and all of that. But I got worse again. So, yeah, you can get more than one strain of influenza. And these days, that is especially something you can do. All right, let's see what else is going on. Well, in some very good news, the vernal equinox will occur next Friday evening, March 20th, 2015, at 6:45 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Oh, I'm so glad we're on daylight time now, because as of today, Saturday, we're going to see the sun setting at 7 o'clock. That is so good. Anyway, I'm looking forward to spring. I really want to see spring. I have not enjoyed the winter at all. Besides getting sick, I have, you know, also just had to bundle up all the time. I can't go out. And being sick and having all this rough weather, that really kept me in for quite a while. So, anti-gay crap is all over the news. On March 3rd, the Supreme Court of Alabama prohibited the state's probate judges from issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. The Alabama court ruled that it doesn't have to follow the rulings of lower federal courts. In its ruling, it promises to, quote, defer only to the holdings of the United States Supreme Court, unquote. The Alabama Supreme Court is the court where this Roy Moore character is the Chief Justice. On the last program, we talked about Alabama's Chief Justice Moore citing, quote, state sovereignty to urge the governor and lower state courts in Alabama to not issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples. And we mentioned that Mr. Moore seems to have not read about the Civil War settling that sort of issue. Moore has also said that he can't separate his religion from his job. Maybe he shouldn't have that job. Anyway, there is now a ruling from Moore's court, and it makes a dangerous assertion. Will the federal courts just allow this? They may just consider it a moot point since the Supreme Court will rule on the issue of same-gender marriage in June. What this Moore character is doing seems completely illegal and even dangerous to me. We're seeing Moore's bigotry revealing him as a bad American. And then we have, in the news, some neurosurgeon who wants to run for president in the Republican Party has come out saying, oh, well, of course, homosexuality is a choice. Yes, you can. It's proven. It's proven because people go into prison straight and they come out homosexuals. What? What? That's some logic this guy has. What an idiot. Yes, you can be a surgeon and be an idiot. And he proves it. What a jackass. He then apologized, tried to backpedal because he was shown to be such an idiot that it didn't look good. I don't think this guy's going to be president anytime soon. And then we've got some Catholic school teacher from New Jersey who has written Facebook pages saying that gay and lesbian people, I'll assume bisexuals are included in there too, are destroying Western civilization. And she goes on this long rant on Facebook about it. And the school, I mean, it was so bad that the Catholic school said, you got to take that down. This is too awful. And one of her former students is a person in Hollywood, and he's famous now, and he has written to her and saying, well, you know, you used to be an okay person, but looking at this, by the way, I'm gay and I'm married to a man, and gee whiz, you know, come off it, lady. So, wow. So there's some anti-gay bigotry marching forth these days, and I'm going to cough again. In other earth-shattering news, oh, well, there they go. Okay. That's the chickens. Yes, WBAI doesn't just go on the air raising money. We have off-air fundraising initiatives, too. Among them, we're raising chickens in the back. Anyway, WBAI will be moving soon, and they're having to get the chickens moving around because, you know, that we got to get them out of here. WBAI is going to be moving soon. We'll be broadcasting from these CCNY studios until March 31st. After that, we're supposed to be using a studio set up at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, where WBAI has its offices at present. I'm sure the move will go off without a hitch and be an excellent example of good planning and execution of a coherent plan.
This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a hilltop in Harlem and streaming live at WBAI.org. The program is back of the book. He is our Paul Martin, and she is Radio Spiegel of the North. You can find out more by going to his website at glib.com. You can also look at WBAI.org, the official website of this radio station. There is also WBAI.net, a listener group's website, and then there is the Bleep and Blue Board at listenerforums.net, where listenerforums is one word.
NASA's Dawn spacecraft is in orbit around the asteroid Ceres. Yes, Ceres started out being a planet in 1801, which, by the way, disproved one particular anti-Semitic philosopher's theory of how, yes, this is the way the solar system has to be because, and he gave a long reason, and then they found Ceres in 1801, and it blew his whole assertion away. Anyway, Ceres started out being called a planet in 1801 because all they could see was a dot, And they, it took a while to figure out that it was a lot smaller than any of the other planets. And so then it got called an asteroid. Lately, it has been reclassified as a dwarf planet. Yes, with these obsessions certain astrophysicists have for, let's rename things. We don't want Pluto to be a planet. You know. I'll still call Ceres an asteroid. The Dawn spacecraft is currently looking at the night side of Ceres. In April, it's going to move around to the day side of the largest asteroid in the solar system. At that point, maybe we'll get a better look at those two bright spots that Dawn saw on Ceres' surface earlier. No, it will not turn out to be space aliens signaling us. In 2011 and 2012, Dawn orbited Vesta, the second largest asteroid, which is interesting because the Dawn spacecraft has become the first human-launched object that is orbiting two different celestial bodies. It orbited Vesta, and now it's orbiting Ceres. And the thing is that the asteroids are pretty easy to get away from. Their escape velocity is low. So the spacecraft was able to orbit Vesta for a while and pick up information on it, and then start boosting itself out and going to Ceres and going over there. And it's going to look at a lot of things. Yeah, you know, and I'm seeing doofuses saying, oh, it's space aliens on Ceres. And you know, why would the space aliens choose Ceres to do it? Why would the space aliens just do things in this way? I mean, I can't stand some of this. All right, let's see here. In other scientifical news, there's been a discovery of a fossil jawbone which pushes the genus Homo back by about 400,000 years to about 2.8 million years ago. And, you know, this is a discovery. It was done in the Afar region of East Africa, where you get a lot of these things, because that's apparently where humanity really, really started out. Although, that long ago, they weren't human beings yet, but our truly, truly, really ancient ancestors of the genus Homo, well, they appear to have started earlier than had been thought. In the Daily News, just to show you how, you know, you get this bizarre reporting from people who apparently have absolutely no real understanding of the sciences, and maybe not much else. In the Daily News, the reporter says, quote, everything you know about our ancestors' evolution might be wrong, unquote. And that's about this story of, you know, a student finding a fossil that pushes the genus Homo origins back to at least 2.8 million years ago. And geez, what an idiot the reporter has to be. I mean, that particular line at the top of everything, that does not really indicate what the story's about. What the story's about is pushing back the time when the genus Homo must have begun. And it doesn't knock everything out. It doesn't make everything else wrong. It just says, oh, well, now we've discovered something earlier. This has been anthropology for, you know, the past 100-some-odd years, 150 years or so, whatever. And Christ, you know, this is like the TV news people who go on and prattle on about some things and really indicate that they have absolutely no idea what the hell they're talking about. And it's kind of annoying because they get to show up and say, hey, millions and millions of people, this is what's happening. And people go, huh? And they give these people the misinformation and, geez, what terrible stuff. All right. There's that. Speaking of terrible stuff, those ISIL scumbags are destroying ancient artifacts they've even bulldozed the ruins of the ancient city of Nimrud as a part of their religious fanaticism. I mean, this group, you know, murder, rape, destruction of art, and an attempt to erase history? Yeah, these creeps need to be stopped by any means necessary as soon as possible. And, God damn, you know, I mean, wow. Disgusting people. This is religious fanaticism. Now, they're not the only ones who've ever done it. You'll notice that a lot of ancient statues in Egypt, those statues from 3,000 years ago, well, 3,000 years ago, a lot of them, but 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, you'll notice that a lot of them, the faces are defaced, the noses are smashed off. Well, that was done by Christian fanatics a very long time ago. They said, no, this is idolatry. It's the same stuff that the ISIS, ISIL creeps and the Taliban creeps have been saying these days. They were saying, 1,000-odd years ago. So, yep, religious fanaticism, it's destructive and it's terrible, and who the hell needs it? All right.
This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a hilltop in Harlem and streaming live at WBAI.org. The program is Back of the Book. He is our Paul Martin, and she is Radio Spickles of the North. You can find out more by going to his website at glib.com. You can also look at WBAI.org, the official website of this radio station. There is also WBAI.net, a listener group's website, and then there is the Bleep and Blue Board at listenerforums.net, where listenerforums is one word.
Well, so here we are today, and although you're hearing me on the 14th, I'm really recording all of this on the afternoon of Friday the 13th. Yes, no trichodecaphobia here at all. Is that trichodecaphobia? Whatever the hell it's called. No fear of Friday the 13th here. We're just going to keep trundling along and see how it works. Anyway, so today is 314. It's Pi Day. No, not the pi you shove into your face. It's pi as in the Greek letter pi, which represents the mathematical constant, and generally 3.14, and that's about as close as you're going to get for a date. And yes, I opened the start of the program of reading pi to 50 places. Wowee. And next year, actually, it'll be an even better Pi Day, because then you could say that it's 3.14.16, and 3.1416 is a pretty good value of pi for most purposes. And, you know, pi goes on infinitely. It's a transcendental number, and it doesn't fit in the rational number system. And it goes on literally forever. And an interesting fact I dug up was that in 1949, a team led by George Reitweisner and John von Neumann's very famous in computer circles, came up with the first 2,037 digits of pi with a calculation that took 70 hours of computer time on the ENIAC computer. Now, ENIAC was the first electronic computer. It used 18,000 vacuum tubes, and it was amazingly fast in its day. It was used to compute things during World War II. They computed artillery tables, and I think they might have used it to compute a thing or two for the Manhattan Project, and it was really far and away vastly superior to anything else that had come before it. The best calculator before it was done with relays, and relays take a lot longer than vacuum tubes do. Of course, vacuum tubes take much longer than transistors do, which was the next advance in the field. And then you got your integrated circuits, which we're still using today, and which keep getting smaller and smaller. Anyway, 70 hours of computer time to calculate 2,037 digits of pi. Most of you who have computers probably have a computer that will do it in far less time. And that shows how things have changed. You at home, I know I do, have a computer that is vastly superior to the best thing the United States government could use in 1949. And the United States government had the best computer in the world then. Anyway, so at the top of the program, I recited pi to 50 digits. I hope you all copied that down. As it turns out, pi to 39 digits is accurate enough to calculate the volume of the known universe with a precision of one atom. So don't worry about, you know, getting too precise. In other news of today, Albert Einstein was born 136 years ago today. I wonder if having been born on Pi Day at all influenced his career choices. You know, I mean, he would have known it, and he would have at some point, probably as a teenager, have noted, oh, 3.14, that's Pi, that's my birthday. And I don't know if they celebrated Pi Day in Germany in those days, but who knows, who knows. Anyway, merry birthday, Al. Ah, yes, a lovely tribute to good old Al. Now, Albert Einstein published a number of scientific papers early in the 20th century. Among these was one about gravity, and that was called The General Theory of Relativity. He had been working on that between 1907 and 1915. His theory of general relativity says that gravity warps space-time. It's not that gravity sucks things in, it's that gravity makes space-time change. It warps it. And it's sort of like you're walking along somewhere and all of a sudden the ground tilts. And that's, you know, that's sort of the way gravity would work. But it's difficult to describe that because that's describing gravity by using gravity. Very difficult stuff. And I'm not going to go try to explain space-time warping any more than that. In fact, the general theory of relativity was tested during the solar eclipse of May 29th, 1919. During that eclipse, the sun's glaring light was obscured by the moon, of course. It was a total eclipse and a long one. And astronomers were able to photograph the eclipse and the area of space near the limb of the sun. And there they found that a star appeared to be in a position which was different from where it should have been. This showed that the light from the star had indeed been bent by the sun's gravity, having warped space-time. And yes, because gravity follows the inverse square law, and the closer you get to the source of the gravity, the stronger the gravity is. So the gravity would have affected a star that would have been very, very near the limb of the sun. And, you know, a star that would should have been obscured by the sun would in fact be made to appear next to the sun because of the warping of space-time by the gravity. And, you know, you could see the star, and this proved it. This particular result is what made Albert Einstein famous to the world at large. Prior to that, he'd had special relativity, and if you had known some things, you would have said, wowie. And he had also published a paper in 1905, his miracle year, describing Brownian motion, which had been a big mystery. And he also published a paper on the photoelectric effect, describing that. And that is what got him his Nobel Prize in 1921. A lot of people think he won it for relativity, but no, he won it for describing the photoelectric effect. And he got that 17 years after he had published that paper. Relativity was still kind of scary to people. A lot of physicists were saying, geez, this is bizarre. Can this be? And of course, some people said, this is nonsense. This can't be. It's too bizarre. And so they weren't going to give him a Nobel for the for relativity, but they said, wow, look at this other stuff, like Brownian motion and the photoelectric effect. And they gave him the Nobel for the photoelectric effect, which is absolutely worthy of it. All of those papers in 1905 were worthy of a Nobel. But you can only win one Nobel in a particular field. That's why Madame Curie has two, because she won one in physics and one in chemistry. And I'm punctuating the radiator with coughing here, and I'm editing a lot of stuff out, folks. Oh boy, I am definitely not over the flu yet. Anyway, some years later, Einstein and other physicists extrapolated this effect of general relativity, where light was on a curve as it passed by a body with high gravitation, and they extrapolated this to a phenomenon that was called gravitational lensing. Now, gravitational lensing occurs when light from very different objects, like galaxies in the early universe, is bent in such a way that it's effectively magnified. And this is a bit different from the light passing near the sun, because that was just a small thing, and you got to see a star that was very near the limb of the sun change position. This involves much larger bodies. This involves galaxies and galaxy clusters. And this was quite the theory. And people said, wow, that's an interesting idea. Another one of these. And Einstein wasn't the only guy predicting this. In fact, he wasn't even the first one to predict this. But he wrote the most famous paper about it in 1936. It was only in 1979 that gravitational lensing was actually observed. And now, something else that had been predicted has finally been observed. Back in 1964, a Norwegian astronomer named Sjur Refsdal first proposed using time-delayed images from a lensed supernova to study the expansion of the universe. Astronomers have been looking for such a phenomenon since then. Last week, astronomers using the Hubble Space Telescope announced that they had observed a supernova, the image of which had been split into four separate pieces. And when it's cut into four separate pieces like that, it's called an Einstein cross, for obvious reasons. This powerful lensing effect, this Einstein cross, is the result of the light from the supernova, located about 9.3 billion light years from Earth, passing through galaxy cluster MACS J1149.6+2223. Did you write that down? You should write that down right next to pi to 50 character to 50 digits that I did before. And so the light is from 9.3 billion light years away, and it passed through galaxy cluster and around a massive elliptical galaxy in that cluster. And that's about 5 billion light years from the Earth. And astronomers discovered this Einstein cross in November of last year. Patrick Kelly from the University of California, Berkeley, who's one of the people working on this, said, "It really threw me for a loop when I spotted the four images surrounding the galaxy. It was a complete surprise," unquote. The current four-image display is going to fade away in time, but scientists have been running computer models on this galaxy cluster, and they say that they expect this same image to reappear in about 5 years. Their computer models also indicate that this particular Einstein cross appeared about 20 years ago. The reason for the repeated manifestation of these images over such a long time frame is owing to the different paths the light has taken before it reaches the Hubble Space Telescope orbiting Earth. One of the people working on this project, Steve Rodney of the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, said, quote, "Our model for the dark matter in the cluster gives us the prediction of when the next image will appear. We already missed one that we think appeared about 20 years ago, and we found these four images after they had already appeared. The prediction of this future image is the one that is most exciting because we might be able to catch it. We hope to come back to this field with Hubble, and we'll keep looking to see when that expected next image appears," unquote. All of this is very interesting in and of itself, but the phenomenon of the time delays and the calculations the scientists are using to predict them are allowing the scientists to build a model of the dark matter in the elliptical galaxy and in the cluster. And this will give us more information on dark matter itself, which makes up about 74% of the mass of the universe, and which is so far very mysterious stuff. So this is interesting. The fact is that the light is not only being lensed, but it's taking these various different, apparently pretty long, paths, and it's being affected by the dark matter in that galaxy cluster and in that particular large elliptical galaxy. And so it's being looped around. And 20 years ago, the light first hit and it would have made an Einstein cross. And then now there's an Einstein cross, and they're saying there will be a third one. I guess it'll be the final one in about 5 more years when you'll get the Einstein cross again. Very interesting stuff. The light is being taken on these various journeys in different directions, and some of the light is coming at us more directly than other packets of light, and it's all getting lensed around this thing. The universe is just so bloody amazing, isn't it? Wow. All right, well, let's talk about something that's a little bit contemporary and quite a New York thing, quite a Brooklyn thing, I should imagine. There's this viral video that's going around the entire goddamn world, and it involves a group of high school kids who, at a McDonald's on Flatbush Avenue, just south of Church Avenue in Brooklyn by Erasmus Hall High School, this bunch of young women jumped on another young woman. A bunch of 16 and 17-year-olds jumped on this 15-year-old girl, and they beat the crap out of her. And they all jumped on her, started beating her up. Apparently, I'm reading, I don't know, I certainly wasn't there, I'm reading that what happened was there was a beef between the leader of this group, which is part of a gang, it turns out, and the leader of the gang had a beef against the 15-year-old because she had said something. And I suppose when you're a teenager, somebody said something is a perfectly good reason to go commit a felony. Unfortunately, there are adults who even think that too. However, so what happens is these kids, the gang had been hunting for this 15-year-old apparently since January, and they found her at the McDonald's the other day, and so they close in on her, and reportedly, the 15-year-old throws the first punch, and then the others go after her. The gang leader hits her, and after she hits her, 5 or 6 other kids jump on her, and it's just a general beatdown from a gang. And in the newspapers and all, there's a lot of hand-wringing about, oh, there were even 2 adults in there. Why didn't they jump in and stop this? Why didn't they do something about it? I don't know. I mean, are the people who write these things, are they living in Iowa or something? What the hell? You're sitting in a McDonald's. It's jammed with teenagers. That alone means it's loud and the kids are probably doing stupid stuff, you know, ordinary stupid stuff, and they're kind of annoying the way they behave, and that's just life. They're teenagers. We were all teenagers once. We were all annoying teenagers once. I know I was. Anyway, so the kids are in there, you're sitting in there, and all of a sudden, there's this fight breaking out, and, you know, there's a melee. You're supposed to jump up and stop this? What? No. If I were sitting in a McDonald's and this happened, I would make sure, if I were with Pickles of the North, I'd make sure that Pickles was in a protected position, and so was I, and I'd move back a bit. Would I call 911? Maybe I would. It would depend on whether or not some of the gang is looking at me to see what I'm going to do next, in which case I might leave and then call 911. But the idea of going in and trying to physically break up this gang assault is absurd. I mean, you try to do that and you're going to end up, you know, who knows what. I mean, do any of these kids have knives or guns on them? If they do and you start barging in, that may be the last stupid thing you ever do in your life. Furthermore, if you're male and you go charging and you got all these teenage girls. In fact, during the fight, one of them tore the other one's hood off and she's running around in a bra while she's stomping out the kid who's on the floor, you know, semi-conscious. So what are you going to do? You're going to be a male and jump in and say, "Now, you young ladies, break this up." You put your hands on one of them, they're going to cry rape. Then there's also going to be a racial aspect to it. If you're white or Hispanic or Asian and you go in there and you got a bunch of black kids having a fight, they're going to start hollering, you know, about some racial thing. You'll be called a racist child molester or something, because you've gone in there and tried to break up this fight. So really, it's quite absurd to me, the idea that somebody would say, "Oh, you should go in there and break this up." Besides the fact, five or six kids turning on you probably could beat the crap out of you anyway and knock a few teeth out, put you in the hospital, even if they don't pull out weapons. So I really don't get it. I think this is some kind of posturing going on, and it's tragic that this sort of thing happens. It's just good that they didn't use weapons on the 15-year-old. And it's ridiculous and a lot of posturing, I think, that some people are going on about, "Oh, and none of the adults stepped in to stop it." Jesus Christ. Grow up, people who write these editorials. Oh, there's Mr. Outro music. All right, well, it looks like that's been it for Back of the Book for this fortnight. And yeah, it's another pre-recorded program. Well, we hope we're back here in 2 weeks on March 28th to do a live program. That will be our final trek up that long hill, and it probably won't be as cold as it has been lately. And it will be our final radio broadcast for Back of the Book from CCNY, and after that we'll have the grand adventure of seeing how things work out with doing radio from a room at 388 Atlantic Avenue. And so we hope we'll be back here in 2 weeks. Can't predict, can't tell. And we hope we'll be back here in 2 weeks. Coming up next is Simon Lokely with As I Please. Again, we do not know what's going to be in this time slot next week. Bring back Uncle Sidney. And so that'll be that. All right. We hope we see you in 2 weeks. And go out, enjoy the spring. Again, it's next Friday. And above all, remember what that glad to see spring begin and glad to see the flu end Dormouse said.